Welcome to Leap Year, a podcast about taking chances, making mistakes, and spending a year, or several, leaping into something new. I'm your host, Jess Cadjo, and today I'm talking with writer, actor, comedian, and podcaster, Peter Kim. His TV and film credits include Curb Your Enthusiasm, NCIS, and the upcoming Netflix film, Yes Day, starring Jennifer Garner. He hosts the Ajumma Show podcast with comedian and writer Eunji Kim, where they talk about politics, culture, and every corner of the internet through their uniquely Korean-American perspectives. I interviewed Peter pre-corona, when life was very different, but the nuggets he shares are timeless. If 2020 has taught me anything, it's that this year is both trash and a chance to reset. I have many friends who are moving back home, reassessing their careers, or starting new ventures. It's a really scary time, but I'm hopeful that we'll come out of this with a renewed sense of creativity and a will to take chances. Peter and I had a great interview. It was so good, in fact, we had to split it up into two parts, Real Housewives style. We talked about his experience growing up in a Korean-American family, the pressures of immigrant parents, coming out as gay, and making moves that would further his comedy career. We begin at the epicenter of so many good things, Queens, New York.
I grew up in Flushing, Queens, which is still today a big place for the Korean diaspora. So LA is K-Town and New York's like Queens area is where like a lot of Korean immigrants ended up coming to America. So I grew up with all Koreans, all churchy Koreans, like super evangelical. We would go on retreats and we would be like struck by the gift of tongue, you know, and we'd be like, shamalalalala, you know, just going crazy. And I remember when I was a kid, when I was 11 years old, I was at one of these retreats with like 100 other tweens and everybody was speaking in tongues except for me. And I remember feeling like so left out and I was like, oh my God, the spirit is not touching me today. And then I just had to fake it. And then this girl next to me looked over at me. She was like, that's not real. As if she knew.
Oh my God.
And she could totally tell was making it up. Because everybody else's sounded like the angelic tongue and mine sounded like gobbledygook.
Oh my God. So, you're having also like a parallel experience to my childhood growing up in a black church. And people also speaking in tongues. And you're like, is this meant for me? Am I meant to be doing this? I don't know.
Truly, that's one of the first times I was like, maybe I should be pursuing something else. So it was a lot of that. It was a lot of Christians, a lot of Koreans, especially first generation, a lot of immigrants. Mm-hmm. So it was, a lot of fear.
Yeah.
Completely shrouded in fear and shame. That's how I grew up.
So what made you not feel fearful?
I was attracted to a lot of reading, a lot of writing. I drew a lot. I was a very creative child. At a young age, like fourth or fifth grade, I started playing Dungeons and Dragons with a bunch of other people that also felt like nerdy misfits. Mm-hmm. And get this, today, every single one of those people in my group, all gay now. All queer, a lesbian, bisexual, like a transfer, like everybody is on the spectrum. LGBT. Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And I think back then we didn't have like vocabulary for it.
Yeah.
But we all just wanted an escape and play like gender band. I would always play like a female sorceress. You know, that was like my power, you know, that was my alter ego. So I got lost in a lot of that. Comedy, obviously, when I was in high school. A lot of my friends got fake IDs in the Lower East Side.
Okay.
And they were like charging $50 for a fake ID. And they were like real, where you could like swipe it and it would scan and stuff like that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So everyone was getting one because like club life was really like, it was blowing up.
How old
were you? School. I was like 15.
Club life is blowing up.
Blowing up. Twilo, Limelight. Like, it was when, like, trance was getting big.
Okay.
And everybody was taking ecstasy and, like, wearing those parachute pants and sucking on, like, what are those baby suckers called?
Oh, the one with sugar inside?
No, it was actually, like, for babies.
Oh, I don't know.
I forgot what they're called. Suckers? No. teethers. I forget what it's called. Okay. But, like, you know, people would be acting like
Things that babies teeth on.
Yeah, and then there would be, like, something on it. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. Like, it's like a little nipple or whatever. Yeah. And everybody was, like, in that scene. Well, all my friends were. And I just, like, that wasn't for me. So I didn't get a fake ID, and I ended up going to the Comedy Cellar down in the West Village. And me and my two girlfriends would go on the weekends when all our friends would go clubbing, and we would sit in the back, order two Diet Cokes, the minimum amount, and we would just watch, like, Dave Attell, Godfrey, Dave Chappelle, like, all the greats, all the people that are coming up. This was, like, pre-Amy Schumer, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it was the best.
What was it like to have, like, access to that so young?
I guess growing up in New York City, I didn't think of it as anything different. Mm-hmm. You know, like, growing up in New York, you just imagine the world is like New York, but it's totally not. So I guess now, looking back at it, I was very privileged to have so much culture all around me, music, comedy, arts, dance, you know, like, anything you could think of, you know, and it was so accessible. But, you know, when I was going to those comedy clubs, I knew I was a super comedy fan, but I never for a second thought I could do it. You know, it wasn't a trajectory that was laid out for me, you know? And I never saw anyone doing comedy that looked like me,
right,
besides Margaret Cho, who it was a couple generations ahead of me. And whenever I saw her do stuff, I remember my mom would turn off the TV and she was like, "You can't watch her."
Why did she say that?
Because she was a shameful Korean. Because she had tattoos, she was talking about queerness, you know, and she was very radical for a Korean American. And there was a point where, like, she was being written up in the Korean newspapers as, like, "Oh, this person is bringing shame to our country, to our people." Like, it was crazy. And she was a punk rock, you know, at that point. And I remember thinking, like, "Oh, I'm not brave enough to be her." Mm-hmm. So there was never, like, someone that looked like me, acted like me, that did comedy. So I always thought of it as, like, I just looked at it as a fan. And never as someone who could actually participate in it.
Right. Yeah. It's not really, you can't actually do it. You can just watch it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a big theme, at least in my childhood. Most of my girlfriends who are Black or of color, of having to meet a certain standard that our families have established for us.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect you in terms of what you decided to go into, like, going to college?
Sure.
Pursuing a career.
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't know anyone that didn't go to college. You know, out of all my immigrant Korean friends, like, everyone went to college, if not a Ivy League college. You know, and I also went to a school, high school called Bronx High School of Science.
Okay.
Which is, like, a huge, like, it is pretty big, but it is known to be one of the best schools in New York City. And you have to test to get into it. So once I got into that school, everybody around me there was like almost a 0% dropout rate.
Dropout rate, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. And it was 42% Asian. So we were like the majority of the high school. And instead of like theater programs, we had computer programs and aerospace and like technical drawing. You know, like, it was very like science and math based.
So you're seeing yourself everywhere, but like in a certain field.
In a very certain field, which is highly finance driven, highly math or science driven, medicine driven, chemistry driven, you know, so like everyone was like obviously so stereotypically trying to go to med school, trying to go to law school, mm-hmm. trying to just make as much money as you can so that your parents don't regret immigrating.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. And that's like the type of pressure that we as, you know, children of immigrants and POCs in general have to deal with, because there isn't this added pressure for our white counterparts because they have the luck of having generational wealth. In America, we just don't have that. So we only have one road that we can even look at.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I never thought of being in entertainment or being an artist was even possible. It was laughed at, you know? So I didn't even want to go to college, to be honest. In high school, I was just like not even thinking about college. And then my parents were pressuring me, obviously. And then the school, the State University of New York, Stony Brook, which is a school out in Long Island. It's one of the state schools of New York. They came to our school and pre-approved us by our transcripts because they really wanted us to go to that school. So I didn't even apply to go. They just approved me and said, "If you want to come, you can come." almost for free. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll go to college. It was like a crazy thing. Obviously, you know, I did well in school. So like, my SATs were fine. You know what I mean? And I had extracurricular. So like, on paper,
yeah,
I was a great student for them. But like, I had no motivation to go to college because I just didn't know what I wanted to do. Except I knew I wanted to be rich. I just wanted to be richer than everyone else. I never wanted to like struggle like my parents again. I never wanted to have to hear them knock on a door looking for rent.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was every month of my life when I was in high school. And my dad was so embarrassed that he would make me go open the door, you know, so that the landlord wouldn't yell at him. And it was like, and this is like so heartbreaking, but it is a very common thing for immigrants.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they don't know the language, so I would have to like, I remember like, my dad had like 10 speeding tickets or something, and I had to like write on my typewriter, on my like electronic typewriter, because I didn't have a computer, I had to type out letters to the court for my dad so that to like beg for mercy. So that was how I grew up. I grew up so fast, and I didn't really have a chance to be a kid,
right,
especially in New York. Like, growing up in New York is tough. You get toughened up quick. You either get eaten up or you get chewed out.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I traveled 2.5 hours to school each way, 3 buses and 2 trains. So it was a total of 5 hours of commuting just to go to high school. So I was sick of it. I just was so sick of school. I hated it. The only thing I liked was boys, secretly, you know, like, boys drinking, getting drunk or, like, fucked up, and comedy. That's all. And, I mean, not much has changed today.
So talk to me a bit about that when you're, like, okay, you go to college and you're trying to determine what you're going to do with your life.
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking?
Well, my first year of college, I was just kind of a wash. I had no idea what I was doing. I hated going to the school, SUNY Stony Brook.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't far away enough, and I was still deeply in the closet. And I just, you know, obviously I wanted to come out, but I just didn't know. I was scared. I was too scared to do it around anyone I knew. So I transferred to the University of Michigan afterwards. I had a really great GPA my first year, and I was really determined to just like get out. And when I got out and went to Michigan, to the Midwest for the first time, out of New York, it was quintessential like college experience, Americana.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is so different than how I grew up. And in Michigan, I studied psychology because, you know, I was dealing with a lot of my own stuff. So I was like, I just want to learn more about why I am the way I am, why people behave the way they behave, all that kind of stuff. And while I was doing it, like, other people were like, you know, going to business school or doing econ and, you know, organic chemistry, etc. I just didn't want to do any of it. You know, all I knew was what I wanted to be funny.
Like what you're hearing? Go over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening from and give us 5 stars. Putting content together is hard work, and your quick validation will be a boost to my ego and will bump this podcast up on the charts. Thanks so much. Now let's get back to the show.
And so I moved from New York to San Francisco. And I spent 7 years in tech doing that kind of work and making a shit ton of money. And I was like, yes, finally, I'm rich. And it felt so good to be rich. And I was like that douchebag, you know, working for Yahoo in like 2005. So, you know, on the outside, I was set.
Mm-hmm.
I was sending money home. You know, I was sending my mom. I was buying my mom.
How did
like,
that feel?
Amazing. It was the first time I felt like I am doing my duty as a son. And I never felt like I did. And it was the first time I was able to buy her like Prada wallets and bags and like, you know, Gucci shoes, like whatever she wanted. You know, for me, it was, if my mom could feel a little status, then I've done my job.
Yeah.
And I sent home money every month for them to help with their mortgage and stuff like that. So I felt like really good.
Like you're fulfilling your duties.
Yeah.
All of them.
I felt like that's my purpose.
Right.
you know? And, but I was very unhappy still. And it was because I still hadn't come out. And, one day.
So how old were you at this point?
24. Yeah. 24, 25. And my friend, when I was living in San Francisco, I moved to San Francisco to come out. I was like, I'm far away from everyone. I know. This feels good. Again, this feels safe, you know? And my friend came out to a comedy show with me because he was like, you're feeling sad, you know, why don't we go out and just like have a good time and just like take our minds off of work or whatever. So we go to this comedy show and it was so funny. And at the end they say, oh, we're teaching classes to do comedy. And he goes, why don't we take this class? You know, you just moved to SF. Like, we don't have much to do besides work. So, like, why don't we do this? And I was like, I don't know. He was like, come on, it'll be fun. You know, you'll meet some new friends. And, you know, at that point, I was like, meet new friends, meet new kind of gay friends, queer friends. Like, this is a way to, like, reach out and, like, really expand my world. So I was like, okay, fine, let's do it. And then that Monday came around. And this class was at 7 p.m. I'll never forget. I walk in and I'm like so scared because all these white people, you know, that one POC, all taking the stand-up class. Everyone's like exactly what you think in your brain, you know?
It's so alienating.
So alienating, so unwelcoming. And I sat down. I'm waiting for my friend, Bob. You know, it's 7 o'clock. He's late. And I'm like, where are you? He doesn't respond. The teacher starts talking, like, hey guys, so this is what we're doing, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, Bob, where are you? He finally texts back, sorry, I can't come. I'm not gonna make it. I was like, what? I'm gonna do this class alone? You said I was supposed to ask. So it was the first time I felt so completely outside my comfort zone and so like, I had never felt so betrayed. And I was so mad at him and I was like, I'm never talking to you again. And then I took this class and my first time going up and doing stand-up, I came out to the audience. And I said, hello everyone, my name is Peter Kim, and I'm gay. And everyone just looked at me, and then looked back down at their notebook, as if they were like, okay, and? What else you got?
Is that supposed to be funny?
Yeah, is that a joke? Write a joke, bitch. And I was like, oh my god, no one cares? Nobody cares. And it was the first time the inside, what I was thinking inside was outside. And when it finally was outside, I realized no one else was paying attention to those thoughts but me. And it felt so liberating and scary, but powerful and exhilarating. And then since then, it's just been, yeah, that's history.
How long were you taking classes, like while you were working at Yahoo before you decided, like, I'm going to really do this legit?
Sure. Great question. So I was working at Yahoo full time. Luckily, though, I was in this position, especially in tech and like any kind of emerging industry, whenever anything grows too much, there's like so much, there's so many over hiring that I wasn't really doing much work in the day. So I was given the opportunity to like write and like, and also you worked during the day and night you would go out and hit up open mics and like go see shows and stuff like that. So I was really living like a full ass day and night. For about a year, I took classes, and then that was 2009, and 2010, in 2009, that full year, I took probably every class I could in New York and LA. So I would fly to New York on the corporate card, set up meetings. Set up, go to client meetings and be like, hey, I'd love to talk to you about this, blah, blah, blah. And then do the meeting. And then the meeting would be over at 1. So from 2 to 4, I would take class. And then I would go to another meeting. And I would just like, I literally stitched it into my life.
That's the immigrant mind at work.
Yes, that's the hustle.
That's the hustle at work. I mean, for real.
Yeah. I was hustling. For a whole year, I would fly to New York to take classes at UCB at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. And then I would take classes in LA. And I would go see shows at the Comedy Cellar, at the Laugh Factory, at Comedy Store, like all these places. I would go bounce around as much as I could, because in San Francisco, there was a burgeoning comedy scene, but at least for improv and sketch, there really wasn't a centralized space. So I fell in love with this long-form comedy, and I really wanted it to exist in San Francisco, but there was just nothing like it. So I ended up meeting a bunch of people that I liked. I went to their shows and just kind of like scouted them, literally went up to them and was like, I really like you, this is who I am, would you want to come play with me? And then I assembled a team of like 5-6 people, and I started this show called Fucking Free Fridays.
That's a good name.
It was in Union Square. Thank you. It was at Union Square, 10:30 p.m. on Fridays. And it was a free show, and there was nothing like it in SF. And I just asked these guys, like, would you just take a chance on me and like and just bark outside for like an hour before the show. And I like used the Yahoo printers to print out hundreds of flyers, and I would like send it around to like other people in my department, be like, hey, comedy show, and people would be like, stop bothering me. And then we would be on Fridays at 8:30 p.m. we would meet at the corner of Union Square, and we would be on like a different corner giving out flyers to people walking by for like an hour and a half, and then we would buy beer, go upstairs to the fifth floor of there was a nightclub called the Ruby Sky.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's still there, but on the fifth floor of Ruby Sky, there was this tiny little black box theater thing. And I rented that out for like, I believe it was like, I can't even remember now, like $120 a night or something like that. And we lost money because it was a free show. But I knew that if I gave away good stuff for free, people will come back. And we started the show, and there was like 6 people in the audience in a 50-seat theater, you know? And then a couple weeks go by, there was like 10, 20 people. And then 3 months go by, and it was like almost full. And I was like, okay, we're getting like an organic traction here. And then about 6 months in, someone from Yelp came. And back then, Yelp was it. There was no like Google reviews. It was like Yelp, Yelp, Yelp. And someone from a senior editor from Yelp came, watched the show, did not tell us, and then the following Monday put us on the front page of Yelp as a number one nightlife pick of San Francisco.
Wow.
For 8 months straight. And then there was a line out the door, and it became the biggest thing overnight.
Oh my goodness.
And people were like calling and emailing, like, how do I get you? How do I get tickets? How do I take classes? So it became a huge thing. So in 2 years, while I was still working at Yahoo, I started a comedy theater that became the biggest thing in San Francisco. And by 2012, I was having kind of like an existential crisis. So I was like, I did it. I can't believe lightning struck.
Right.
You know, this happened. I dreamt it. I manifested it. It's here. But why am I so unhappy? And it turns out I'm so unhappy because I don't believe it's real. You know, like, how could I in 2 years become the biggest thing in a city? Mm-hmm. That's just not, I felt like a fraud. So I sold the company for $1 to one of my friends, and left my job at Yahoo, left the entire career. I had $75,000 in the bank savings, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna go to Chicago for 5 years. And I'm going to stretch this for 5 years and just dive in full time. Moved to Chicago in 2012. And the money lasted me 18 months.
Sounds about right.
So I went from making 120 grand a year. And my taxes the next year I made $4,000.
Oh my goodness.
So I went from that, making that much, to that little overnight.
How did your family feel?
My mom was very worried about her bags.
No more Prada.
Not a Prada. you know, at the end of the day, they were supportive, but they were all very confused. They were like, what are you doing? You finally, the American dream, you got it. You're making six figures, you're independent, you have no kids, you have expendable income. Why are you throwing that all away?
Right. What do you mean you're not happy?
Yeah.
How could you not be
happy? How could you not be happy? And I think that's been the biggest schism between the older generation and my generation, is that, you know, they came to America so that we could have a better life. But to them, a better life only revolves around financial status. And they don't understand a better life means freedom from, you know, immigrant pressures, freedom from heteronormativity, freedom from doing anything you don't want to do. You know, that's true freedom. And
things that you can't always put money,
right,
a weighted value on.
Exactly. And money helps you get those things.
Right.
You know, like, look at Caitlyn Jenner.
Right.
You know, like, she has so much money, she doesn't really fall into the trans problem.
Exactly.
You know, so, like, that's exactly it. You
and
know?
It's not,
like,
even so much money, you're not aware of your privileges.
Yeah, Elton John's never going to feel like someone's, like, coming after, you know, because he's gay, you know, like, it's not a problem for the rich. So that's kind of what they really wanted, was like, escape all your problems just by getting rich. But what I realized was that I was, you know, ostensibly rich, you know, I was making a lot of money. I wasn't like the 1%, but like, I for maybe 2 to 4 years, I never looked at my checking account because there was always another check every 2 weeks. An immense amount that, like, my family could only dream of. And then, I was just like, I'm so unhappy. I can't do this. And then I started comedy full time. And my only goal was to get on stage at the Second City, because I knew that was a place I could get paid to do comedy. And I knew, like, these amazing people like Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Stephen Colbert, like, all these people came from there. So it's a historic institution. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna go there, and if I can make it to Second City, then I'll know that I did this for a reason. That would be my barometer of success.
What did you choose for your audition?
Wow. A few characters. Like, one of them was like my mom. Another one was like Kim Jong-un, you know, talking dirty to Dennis Rodman. You know, shit like that, like,
yeah.
Stupid shit that I found funny.
Yeah.
And luckily, the audition for Second City was mostly improvisational. So they just wanted to see that I could improvise, which at that point I'd been doing it for a while, so I had the chops. And of course, you know, I went to the first general audition and got called back and did it and didn't get hired. But they were like, cool, well, do you want to do this other thing while we, you know, develop you as a talent? And I was like, sure, okay. And then I got on the touring company, and then I toured the country, you know, doing Second City's like best of and also writing my own material for them. And then in 2015... at the end of 2015, I got hired to write and perform for their ETC stage, and I was getting paid a weekly salary with Actors Equity. I was part of a union, an actors union. You know, I was getting covered by, like, with health insurance.
I was gonna say, yeah.
Yeah, health
insurance. Real benefits.
Yeah, real benefits, like pension shit. Like, it was crazy. I was like, whoa, is this possible? You can do comedy for real like this? Like, I never thought I could do that. And I did. And, you know, I just really put my head down and thought, like, and I've always been a DIYer, you know. If I wanted it, I just made it. I was like, if I want to perform, I'm going to create a company and perform it. If I want Second City, I'm just going to keep knocking on their doors and keep doing this stuff. And, you know, while I was doing Second City, I was producing my own shows and, like the show Kiki, you know, that was one of maybe like 12 shows I produced while I was in Chicago. I was hosting The Moth, you know, I was doing stand-up, I was hosting like galas, you know, anything to get in front of the mic.
Yeah.
You know, I got in trouble once because I did like a Korean cultural center thing. Like, it was like a fundraiser. And at the end, I was giving out my business cards because people were like, oh my God, you're so funny. Can we get your card? And I was giving out my business cards. At that point was this joke business card of a North Korean flag. And on the, and it just had my Twitter handle on it. And on the other side, it said, don't trust this guy.
So people were like, you're so funny. Yeah. Oh my God, what is
what
this
the
card?
Fuck? Yeah. I don't know. Like, I guess, like, I just, like, I thought it was funny. So, but, like, I didn't realize that these old-ass Koreans who, like, have real experience with the war and, like, Japanese internment and all this, like, pain, they saw it as, like, how could, you know, it's like seeing, like, almost like seeing a Nazi symbol for them, you know? And
like, this is not funny.
That's not funny. And I got in a lot of trouble because of that. And I learned my lesson.
How did you get in trouble? What do you mean by that?
Well, the people who hired me called me afterwards, and they're like, they're threatening not to pay you, blah, blah. Oh, and they're not going to work for us anymore. And I was like, I'll apologize. Like, I sent a letter saying, like, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to offend you. You know, I was being stupid, you know, like, whatever. And, yeah, I don't know. Like, comedy, I feel like you have to get into trouble one way or the other because you have to, like, test your limits. And that's why you do open mics. That's why you go in front of a crowd because you have to see, like, how far is too far. And sometimes it's too far.
Right.
And you have to, and what I learned was, like, you have to have enough humility to be like, okay, oop, I was wrong.
Yep.
All right.
I need to back up.
I need to back up. You know, yeah.
How do you play within those boundaries, though? Because I'm thinking both, you know, things that I find funny that maybe my mom won't find funny, mm-hmm. you know, her mannerisms or just, like, her being a black mom, which to me is hilarious in itself, or my, like, African relatives and the things I find inherently funny about that, versus doing this as a career and having to audition where people could almost pigeonhole you into doing those types of roles. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you balance that between, like, I find this funny, but also, like, is this what I do in my own company and what I can't do in, quote, mixed company? Do
yeah,
you have
that? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was just talking to two of my gay friends yesterday, and I made some awful joke. I forgot what it even was, to be honest. Like, but it's, you know when you're around your friends, you can joke about things because there is already
an understanding
in a context that we are joking, we are trying to shock each other.
Yes.
And we're not trying to be offensive.
Right.
But outside of that context, it can be. So I think it's really knowing your audience. Luckily, I've traveled the country enough to know, like, what a median barometer is for jokes. And, you know, I don't know what it is would be now. I'm sure it's crazy. But, like, I try to... My rule of thumb is that fail and get back up. You know, because I'd rather see an artist try and evolve and extend, then be safe. But I think with that, what I've learned is the best way to approach it is with humility and not like ego. Not to be like, well, fuck you, I think this is funny, and if you don't think it's funny, you're wrong. It's like, no, you don't have to approach it that way. You could approach it as like, what do you think about this? Oh, you don't like it? Okay, duly noted. Gonna get back to my notepad and scratch it out. You know, like, some people are just not going to respond the same way, you know, and that's okay, you know?
And it's having enough understanding to say, like, this is not for this audience.
Exactly.
It's not meant for them.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us for part one of Peter's interview. You can follow Peter at PeterKZ on Instagram and Twitter. You can listen to his podcast, The Ajumma Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Leap Year is a production of Leap Year Podcast, LLC. Editing by Jess Cadjo and the incredible LaCase Cousineau. Music by Jess Cadjo and the uber-talented Matt Boyer. Created, hosted, and produced by me, Jess Cadjo. You can follow our team on Instagram and Twitter at Jess Cadjo, at LaCase Cousineau, and at Boyer. All social handles are in the show notes. Finally, thank you to my family and friends who supported me in this endeavor, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.